This is The Guardian.
I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. ...2021 is coming to a close, and all this week we're taking a look at the biggest stories that defined this past year. Today, we're looking at the world of science. Now, this year, there's definitely been a lot of good, from wacky discoveries to life-saving breakthroughs, including the COVID-19 vaccine, but also many others. But, as per usual, there's always some science and science reporting that's not so good. Today, the best and worst of science in 2021. It's Tuesday, the 21st of December. Mel and Donna, I feel like it's been a very interesting year to be a medical editor and a science reporter. What has this year been like for both of you reporting in these fields?
Long.
Donna Liu is a science reporter at Guardian Australia.
Yeah, I agree with Donna. It's been pretty long.
Melissa Davey is the medical editor at Guardian Australia.
And also just so tumultuous, I think. You know, just like never knowing when the story is going to be over or what variant will emerge or where an outbreak will occur or what the virus is doing. It can often be hard to see an end in sight.
Do you feel like it's been, you know, I suppose an interesting challenge trying to discredit all of the different scientific stories and scientific theories that are coming out from every which way over the past year?
I find it just is hard to stay on top of everything for a start. And then also just accepting that sometimes you and other people are just going to be wrong when there is such a, I mean, yes, we're two years into the pandemic, but we're still learning a lot. And that's not really a very long time for a new virus. So it's accepting that, you know, even at the very beginning of this pandemic, when we first heard of this virus emerging, even back then, I was like, oh, I'm sure it'll be no big deal. It'll go away. Remember all the hype about bird flu and SARS and other things? Obviously, they were concerning and did affect people, but they didn't become quite the global phenomena that we were worried about. And so my instinct is always to just really play it cool and cautiously. And, well, wasn't I wrong about that?
So if we're looking at science reporting across the year that was 2021, where on earth do we start? Where would you like to start?
I feel like Donna had a lot of the coolest, most exciting stories in science this year. Like, how do we choose between echidna penises and sharks?
Yes, we have Donna to thank for bringing the image of the echidna penis. Donna, I think first, tell us about the impact of this story. It was an incredibly popular story.
Yes, and I think some people felt like it should have come with a content warning. I'm not sure how many people know this, but the echidna penis has four heads and only two become erect at any one time. And This year, Australian researchers uncovered the baffling mystery about why this is the case. These scientists discovered echidnas actually only ejaculate from two of their four penile heads at one time. And it's got this unusual reproductive anatomy that's the cause of this phenomenon.
What do you mean unusual reproductive anatomy? What's happening here?
So essentially what the scientists have discovered is that the echidna penis is actually like two separate penises that happen to be merged together. And it's the first time this has been found in mammals before, but scientists aren't quite sure what the evolutionary reasons for it are. Interestingly, there was one particular echidna at Currumbin Wildlife Sanctuary in Queensland who they discovered liked being held, and if they put pressure on his belly, it would cause him to get an erection. And it is a bit full on, but this is how they ended up discovering how the anatomy of the animal works.
So it's actually only two penises that look like four penises. Is this? I didn't think I'd be saying penis this much in the start of this wrap of the best and worst of science.
It's actually one penis that is acting like two separate penises, which has four heads on it.
What is the evolutionary purpose of this, Donna?
They don't know. That's still the mystery. They looked at other animals with multiple penile heads to try and figure out whether or not it might have been some kind of, you know, mating benefit, but they're still not quite sure why it is the case in echidnas.
So you mentioned one of the other big hits of Donna's involved sharks. What is this, Donna? What is the shark reporting?
There was one particular shark story that I found quite interesting because basically it gave evidence to the theory that shark attacks might be a case of mistaken identity.
What do you mean mistaken identity?
Basically, these researchers looked at the visual acuity of juvenile great white sharks, and they focused on juveniles because these young great whites are responsible for a large proportion of attacks on humans, and they have worse eyesight than adults, and they also have a greater overlap of habitat with humans. And essentially what they did is they compared video footage of swimmers, people paddling on surfboards, and seals from a shark's eye view, from what it would look like from below as a great white shark is looking up with the kind of silhouette against the background skylight. And what they found was that it's quite difficult for these juvenile sharks to tell the difference. In fact, there's no difference that they could find between the shapes of a seal or a swimmer or a surfer paddling, which seems to support the theory that these sharks aren't mindless killers. We just happen to look like their prey.
Which really doesn't make me feel more confident about getting into the ocean and swimming over summer.
Well, actually, I grew up in a small surfy town on the Central Coast, and it's interesting that this study kind of confirms a widely held belief. I mean, I used to always say to other people, don't worry, they just think you're a seal. Just try and look like a human if you're out in the water. This was what we said all the time. It's just, oh, they think you're a
How
seal.
How do you try and look like a human as opposed to a seal?
Well, one, wetsuits unfortunately make you look more like a seal because you've got this dark rubbery material all over you. So wear a bikini, you know, everyone just wear a bikini. Don't take that as scientific fact. It is not.
Mel, if it does make you feel better though, shark bites are incredibly rare. Our colleagues Nick Evershed and Josh Nicholas put together this great interactive quiz about assessing risk of rare events. And according to that quiz, essentially your chances of being bitten by a shark in Australia each year are only one in 975,000.
Noted. Okay, thanks. Still don't feel safe.
There was one more shark-related development, which I think may save lives. There's this emergency department doctor, Dr. Nicholas Taylor, who's also a surfer, and he has developed a technique for how you might treat a lower leg wound as a result of a shark bite. Dr. Taylor was looking for ways to make himself shark-proof, and he spoke to surf lifesavers and surfers, and he found that most people would instinctively react to one of these bites by either placing direct pressure on the wound or attempting to make a tourniquet from material they had on hand. And as an emergency doctor, he knew this was actually a bad mistake.
So essentially a tourniquet meaning you kind of wrap something around a limb to cut off the blood flow so that someone doesn't bleed out, essentially. I know a lot of surfers try and do this with, say, a leg rope or, you know, wetties or a board shorts. Why is this a bad idea and what do they suggest doing otherwise?
What they suggest doing is a technique called, I guess the easy way of remembering it is push hard between the hips and the bits. You need a second person. So say if someone's been bitten on the leg, the second person makes a fist and presses into the groin of the person who has been bitten right at the midpoint between the hip bone and the genitals. And so you have to use your body weight to apply pressure to stop the blood flow traveling down the leg and bleeding out from the wound site.
It's such a simple sounding technique, but as you said, this could save a lot of lives in Australia if everyone just knew, you know, press between the hips and the bits. That's it.
Simple as that.
And it sounds like you kind of need a second person to do this if you were attacked. So don't swim alone, don't surf alone is the other message I'm getting from this.
Next, the worst of science in 2021, including some questionable but popular COVID treatments. So as we know, things were pretty dire at the start of the pandemic when we had no vaccines. We also didn't really have any treatments for when people became very ill, apart from kind of supportive care and intensive care. Mel, I feel like a lot of your work this year has been investigating all kinds of unproven and crazy treatments that have popped up throughout the year that people have really latched onto in a way that I've never seen before in my lifetime. I mean, both Mel and Donna, what have you seen this year in terms of COVID cures that really gave you pause for thought, that really shocked you maybe?
I don't know whether it's shocking so much as sad that I found this year, particularly because the vaccine has become so widely available and we know it is the most effective way of reducing both severe illness and hospitalization and death due to COVID. And because there are a number of very good vaccines available, it's still shocks me that people talk about natural immunity and the fact that your body can just fight off a COVID infection if it's healthy, when we know that the risk of that is high death rates in particularly places like the US and the UK. This idea of natural immunity has become really politicized overseas.
So people are saying my immunity is, I don't even need the vaccine. And it's like, you need the vaccine and you need the booster.
Give me all the boosters.
Everyone needs as much help as they can get.
Exactly.
So what kind of really stood out to you this year, Mel, when looking at the issue of unproven COVID cures?
I think the most concerning thing for me is that there have been some scientists and doctors and nurses, you know, people you would think of as really qualified people, who are pushing and promoting some of these unproven treatments and cures. And that's where it gets really worrying. And that includes some of these people publishing questionable scientific studies.
Mm-hmm. What's an example of a questionable scientific study?
Oh, look, there are a few examples, many examples, really. One I'll just mention quickly was a study that was reported by several mainstream media outlets, which basically found smoking was not associated with adverse outcomes in people admitted to hospital with COVID. It actually even claimed in this paper that smokers were at lower risk of getting the virus. And we know that COVID is a disease that ravages lungs, right? So it's just completely counterintuitive from a common sense perspective that a virus that ravages the lungs would somehow not affect someone who's already affected their lungs by smoking.
Right, Mel, I almost definitely wouldn't go and light up a cigarette if I just found out I had COVID, you know?
Exactly. But what we also found out is that two of the authors on this study had conflicts of interest that they didn't disclose, including that one was a consultant to the tobacco industry, and another one of the authors worked for an organisation that had received funding that ultimately derived from big tobacco. So a senior author of the paper said in a statement that the conflicts of interest were irrelevant to the study's main aims and objectives, but there's a big question to be asked about whether we can really trust this study.
Right, so when this all emerged, what happened to this study?
The study was retracted, so it was taken down, and that's a good thing. The problem is that it can take a long time for these studies to get taken down. In the retraction notice, the editors made it clear that at no point was there a question of any scientific misconduct on the part of the authors, aside from the failure of the two contributing authors to disclose their conflicts of interest relating to the tobacco industry. A senior author on the paper also said in a statement that he disagrees with the retraction and that he considers it unfair, but other studies have been published since this one that do show that if you are a smoker, if you've got damaged lungs, then your impact from getting COVID is much more severe.
Mm. Mel, I feel like we can't talk about unproven treatments without discussing ivermectin. I've seen you on Twitter trying to rationalize and have meaningful conversations with ivermectin fans. Can you remind us what it is and what all the fuss is about?
I know, I should learn my lesson and not engage with the pro-ivermectin crowd. They're very vocal on Twitter. Look, you know, ivermectin kind of became the new hydroxychloroquine this year. Hydroxychloroquine was that malaria drug that was promoted by Donald Trump and others last year, completely ineffective for preventing or treating COVID-19. But anyway, the focus is now on ivermectin, which is a drug used to treat parasites like fleas in livestock. But it's also really useful to treat tropical disease like river blindness in humans. So it does have a good safety profile and it's well used. But it's been pushed by doctors, politicians like Craig Kelly, As a treatment for COVID-19, even though there is no strong evidence yet that it works, either as a preventative or as a cure for the virus. And I guess, as I mentioned, one of the most disturbing aspects of this story is that even doctors and researchers are pushing the treatment, citing or even writing scientific papers that they say are proof that it works. But the problem is when you really read the full scientific papers and you interrogate the data, many of them have been found to be problematic, possibly faked in some cases, and they just cannot be used as evidence that this drug works for COVID.
What's a specific example of that that you've seen? A study that has pushed ivermectin and isn't really reliable?
Yeah, so one of the largest papers that was relied upon by the pro-ivermectin crowd was published by researchers in Egypt. And the problems with this study was actually all exposed by a medical student in London called Jack Lawrence, who was looking at the paper as part of a university assignment in medical school.
God, it really reflects poorly on the university assignments that I did where I didn't, you know, break a worldwide story. What did he do?
This study found that patients with COVID-19 treated in hospital who received ivermectin quite early on in their diagnosis had substantial recovery from the virus. Mm. We're talking a mortality rate reduced by 90% in those people who received ivermectin.
I mean, that sounds quite effective and reassuring.
Oh, it sounds incredible. Except Jack Lawrence realised that the authors had basically run entire paragraphs from press releases and websites about ivermectin, put it through a thesaurus to change keywords, and then put it in their paper and their press releases about the findings. So, I mean, this led to them changing terms like severe acute respiratory syndrome to extreme intense respiratory syndrome. And this is in the paper. So not only is the kind of write-up about the findings just really dodgy, but then the data itself also proved to be just really wrong or suspicious. You know, there are many things, but just off the top of my head, the authors claim to have done the study on only 18 to 80-year-olds, but there were a number of patients in the data set who were under 18. It included data from a non-existent date of the 31st of June. We know that June only has 30 days. And then epidemiologists also began looking at the data. They discovered more errors, and it basically looks like the whole paper was faked.
Even though this does sound like it's been debunked, I mean, what real-world impacts can a study like this have?
I mean, they're still sharing it. It's still out there. And there are other dodgy ivermectin studies that are out there. And we have to remember that this led to hundreds of thousands of people being treated with ivermectin for COVID in places like Latin America and places where you almost can't blame them for relying on this treatment because they don't have the access to vaccines or medical care that we do. So governments began rolling out ivermectin as part of their treatment. People around the world began trying to get ivermectin through other means, like getting it from vets and getting prescriptions online and trying to take it. You know, there have been cases of poisoning with ivermectin. So it does have really dire implications, this bad research.
I feel like this has been the source of a few conversations I've had with both of you over the year, that we have these studies that are published, that become quite popular, that are shared as evidence behind a lot of these conspiracy theories, really, or all of these really disproven treatments around COVID-19. Do we have a deeper issue here that isn't being addressed about the research that people are relying on and the processes behind them?
I think something that we've seen throughout the pandemic is a real increase in the number of papers that are being published on what we call preprint servers. So with that fake ivermectin study, as Mel mentioned, that wasn't peer reviewed. So normally what happens when you publish a scientific paper is that you submit it to a journal, the journal's editors will send it out to people in the field to read the paper and analyze it on its merits to see whether it holds up to scrutiny. And after it undergoes that rigorous peer review process, it then goes on to be published. Mm. And what has happened, particularly throughout the pandemic, but it's becoming a bit more common in certain scientific fields, is that because the peer review process takes so long, what researchers often do is to upload their articles to these servers so that other people in the scientific community can access them instantly, and then they can get feedback. And with the pandemic, because there's such a rush to do the research to find new therapeutics to develop the vaccine over the past year and a half, what has happened is we've seen so many big studies published to preprint servers. There are big UK government health studies that have been published to preprint servers, and plenty of them are very legitimate. Mm. But the issue is that because there's less scrutiny, in some cases, it means that if they can get a lot of traction and they don't get the scrutiny that they deserve, things can take off and run rampant.
Okay, so to wrap up, what developments in science are you both looking forward to in 2022? Is there anything that you're hoping we'll see or that's in the pipeline that you'll be reporting on over the next year?
I would just say that although there has been research that's been put on the back burner or put on hold as everyone has diverted their interests and their funding rightfully to COVID, that has led to the development of some incredible technology and findings that might help with other aspects of medical research. So the mRNA vaccines, for example, they were under development before COVID came along for other conditions. They were fast-tracked because of COVID. And when I say fast-track, the science wasn't fast-tracked, just the bureaucratic processes like getting funding, getting permission, all that kind of stuff was fast-tracked. So we've had all these incredible developments that may prove really useful for other viruses like HIV or even things like cancer. So I think the coming years, it will be really, really exciting to see how some of the breakthroughs with COVID can be applied to other really tricky health problems.
I was going to say the mRNA vaccines bit and then Mel said it.
She stole it. She stole your answer.
mRNA technology is something that I think is really exciting because it's been in development for decades now. It took a pandemic to get an mRNA vaccine to market. But essentially what it means is that you can use this same technology, not just for something like a COVID vaccine, but you can individualize treatments for cancer patients or people with autoimmune diseases or even other non-viral pathogens as well. And I think that's incredibly exciting, this area of individualized medicine, and mRNA technology is just a component of that.
Well, I'm also really excited though to hear about more quirky animal studies and weird findings about echidnas if more of those findings are forthcoming in the new year.
Keep them covered. That's it for today. Thanks to Melissa Davey and Donna Liu for their time. You can find more of their work at theguardian.com, and we have linked to some of the stories discussed in this episode on the full story page. This episode was produced by Ellen Lee Beater and Melissa Davey, with additional production and sound design by Karishma Lithria. Mixing by Daniel Seymour. The executive producers of Full Story are Gabrielle Jackson, Melanie Tate, and me, Laura Murphy-Oates. Okay, catch you next time.